I sure you know what time it is. I sure. It's donkey time. Come on.
Everyone for being so patient. We're just experiencing some more technical difficulties, but Wooden Spoons is coming to you soon.
Oh, donkey, just one hair below me. To me, I'm in staying hell.
Want to acknowledge that we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land and waters of the Cree, Ojibwe, Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake Number 40 First Nation and its territory for our life-giving water. This morning, I'm just going to introduce our program. We're going to have a guest this morning who I will be introducing very shortly. His name is Dimitri Liscarius. And that's going to be for the first part of our program. And the second part of the program, we'll be talking about some of the safety concerns of fake meat. And we will end up with some recipes to share. And so, on this note, I am very pleased to introduce Dimitri Liscarius as our guest this morning. His website reveals that Dimitri has a long-standing legal career with many accomplishments. In 2012, Dimitri was named by the Canadian Lawyer magazine as one of the 25 most influential lawyers in Canada. And in 2013, he was named by Canadian Business magazine as one of the 50 most influential persons in Canadian business, and was also described as the fiercest legal advocate for shareholder rights. In 2020, after years of experience and service to the Green Party of Canada, Dimitri ran for the leadership of the Green Party in Canada and finished second place out of 8 candidates. This morning, we will be focusing on other aspects of Dimitri's work and vision. He is a lawyer, journalist, and activist who embarked on a self-financed trip to Russia, where he lectured to students, presented a think tank, gave interviews, met officials and peace activists. He appeared on Russian media, wrote articles, and tweeted daily what he saw and heard. On June the 22nd, Dimitri came to Winnipeg to talk about his experiences and the importance of working for a peaceful solution to the conflict in Ukraine and in Russia. He'll be sharing his ideas and vision with us this morning. Welcome to Dimitri.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're very welcome. Yeah, your presentation was announced and promoted by Peace Alliance Winnipeg, an organization committed to developing a broad peace movement through actions and educational events that promote understanding of events taking place in the world. So on June 22nd, you were slated to do a presentation at the Canadian Mennonite University on Shaftesbury Boulevard. And it seemed a bit out of time, but the location of the presentation was not readily made available until after one purchased a ticket on Eventbrite, which posed a problem for me because I don't have a cell phone to do that. So I eventually learned that the tickets could be purchased at the door. And when I called someone from Peace Alliance, I learned that the location at the Mennonite University had been canceled due to protests, and a new location was arranged at the Filipino Senior Center on Scurfield and Euclid Street. Then later in the evening of that same day, the second location was also canceled due to public protest, and a new venue was found on McPhillips on Mountain Avenue. So such was your welcome to Winnipeg, where you were deplatformed twice and the venue changing 3 times. Quite surprisingly, though, that the latest location had a pretty good attendance, but the event did get off to a later start. So, Dimitri, would you comment on this ironic phenomenon of being deplatformed because you were promoting peace? What is your reaction?
My reaction is one of astonishment, and I've been candid in saying that in my the latter presentations that I've done on this national speaking tour. You know, I now begin my tour by recounting the deplatforming we experienced not only in Winnipeg but also in Toronto and in Halifax. where we had similar experiences. And fundamentally, this is a message of peace that I've come to share with my fellow Canadians. Well, you may disagree with me in terms of my analysis of how this war happened, what caused it. You may disagree with me as to my analysis of what is happening on the battlefield and where this war is heading, which is something that I should think should greatly alarm us all. But ultimately, whether you agree or disagree with me on those things, what I'm trying to do as this one person, you know, with a view about this matter, is convince people to pursue a peaceful course of action to resolve the war as quickly as possible and end human suffering. And for this, I have been not only deplatformed, I have to deal with every day from morning till night on social media, and sometimes even in the mainstream media itself, which has ignored my tour for the most part, with the worst forms of abuse and vilification imaginable. I collected a small sample of the thousands, and I mean thousands of tweets and Facebook posts and comments in which I have had to put up with the worst insults and frankly outright lies about me. I think it's something to behold. It says something very, very disturbing about the state of the public discourse in this country.
You know, when you're saying that, it just makes you feel like crying, because you are doing such amazing work. First of all, whatever gave you the idea to travel to Russia and take on this project of peace? How did that come about?
Well, over the course, I started writing about this war on my website, DmitriLascaris.org, within days of the invasion beginning in February of last year. I had actually been following the civil war in Ukraine for some time, and we're not told this, but there was a civil war in Ukraine for some 7 years before Russia invaded. The war did not begin in February of last year. The war began in 2014 after the United States and certain European governments helped to orchestrate the violent overthrow of a democratically elected president in Ukraine who was trying to maintain good relations with both Europe and Russia. And for this unpardonable sin, he was overthrown. We know this because there was a recording leaked, possibly by Russian security services, in which Victoria Nuland, the senior State Department official, just said outright who the next prime minister of Ukraine was going to be, a fellow by the name of Yatsenyuk. And he did, in fact, become the prime minister after the president was overthrown. In any event, when the war was launched, I immediately came to the conclusion that this, although I believe the war is a violation of the UN Charter, I also believe it was provoked by the West and that we were potentially heading towards a nuclear war. Since then, since the invasion, we have, in fact, been trapped in a cycle of escalation and counter-escalation. This is heading towards nuclear war. And in fact, a recent poll by Maru and the National Post, I think came out 2 weeks ago or even less, found that over half of Canadians now believe that that's likely where we're heading, amazingly. And yet there are not millions of people in the streets. So from my perspective, we are living through the most dangerous moment in my lifetime and possibly human history. And as you know, as I watched with horror as the escalation and the death and the killing and destruction escalated, I asked myself, what can I do? Is there anything that I can do other than just publish articles on my website and speak out on social media? And it seemed to me that perhaps one thing I could do was go to Russia and try to understand from the people there how they view this conflict and to see if I could somehow facilitate a dialogue. I'd never been there before. Don't speak any Russian. No one invited me. No one paid for my trip. No one compensated me for any of the writing that I've done or activism I've done around this. It was purely as a citizen who's in a privileged position to be able to make that trip at his own expense and to speak out because I'm now largely retired from the practice of law. I saw myself as having an opportunity to make some small contribution towards a dialogue about peace, and that's why I went.
That is just amazing, amazing feat of bravery and commitment. And it's a very sad It saddens me to think that we're in a country like Canada, and free speech is curtailed. The media is not. The mainstream media has let us down in many ways. I think it's quite related to the previous pandemic that we were supposed to have been going through. And I think that was the first trial of using censorship on the population. And so we are now in that state where nobody wants to speak out about anything.
Yeah.
That might be one way of understanding it. I think it's all connected to what happened in the previous years. But yes, there should be a movement for peace on the streets.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, I have to tell you, I think that this tidal wave of propaganda and censorship, I go back a little earlier. I think it actually began when Donald Trump, and by the way, I have been, you know, vociferously critical of Donald Trump from the moment that man began to run for the presidency of the United States. But he defeated Hillary Clinton in 2016, and immediately we were told that he was a Russian stooge and that he won only because of Russian interference in the American election. This was fed to us over a period of some 3 years on a daily basis by mainstream American media. It turned out to be a complete pile of malarkey. There's no truth to it whatsoever. In fact, although the mainstream media doesn't want to talk about it because they were so complicit in spreading this conspiracy theory, evidence has now emerged that the FBI understood that this was a pack of lies that had been invented by the Clinton campaign, first to try to help her to defeat Trump, and then secondly, to justify or explain away her loss to Trump. And from that moment, I've just been amazed at how there's been an escalation in disinformation in the media coming from people who are themselves claiming to be disinformation experts and defenders of the truth. And what are these same people doing, these so-called disinformation experts now? They are clamoring, and they were doing this in the pandemic, to an appalling degree. They are clamoring for anybody who disagrees with them to be silenced and deplatformed, marginalized. And then when this invasion began, this pattern of, you know, disinformation combined with censorship of people who expose it has reached a crescendo that I never thought I would experience in my lifetime. I think, you know, if we manage to survive this war, which at this stage I think is unlikely, given the way things are heading, that we will have a serious question in our society about our ability to speak freely going forward, and we're going to have to tackle that problem real soon.
Yes, and I think there are some hopeful signs on the horizon. The National Citizens Inquiry conducted at least 200 interviews with people across Canada that came to Winnipeg. I think it was in April, and they had presentations from various speakers and people in the city and their experience with the mandates, the COVID mandates, and how they were treated. And it was a real eye-opener for anyone that attended. So the National Citizens Inquiry is still moving forward and planning to disseminate another dialogue. Mm-hmm. And your approach of one handshake at a time is a powerful statement of goodwill. How did you, as a single person, generate goodwill with the people you met? And what ripple effect did that have when you went to Russia without knowing, having the, you know, not speaking the language so well? How did you cope in that situation? I mean, this is quite phenomenal.
Well, the first thing I did is once I decided to go, I contacted, this was about 2 weeks prior to my departure. I arrived in Russia on April 1st, and my visa allowed me to stay there for 1 month. I departed on April 30th. So in mid-March, at which point I had my visa and I was trying to, formulate some kind of an itinerary, I decided to call the Russian embassy in Ottawa. I'd never communicated with them before. And I requested to have a meeting by Zoom with the ambassador of the Russian Federation to Canada. who it turns out had become aware by that point in time that I had become very critical of Canadian government policy towards this war. And so he kindly gave me an hour of his time, and we had a Zoom call in mid-March. I introduced myself to him, told him what my objectives were, and I asked him to put me in touch with experts who could talk to me in English about the economic situation in Russia, about the perspective of the Russian people, or at least the majority of the Russian people. I wanted to speak to people at the Russian Foreign Ministry in Moscow about the possibility of peace and what that might look like. And he facilitated a number of meetings with some people were from the Russian Foreign Ministry. Some of these people were not government employees. They worked with think tanks that are widely respected in Russia. And they met with me. And I also was put in touch by a Canadian academic with a man who, a very interesting person in Moscow, who is a graduate of Oxford University. And he has a degree in Spanish literature, a doctorate in Spanish literature, of all things. And he speaks fluent English, obviously, and he took me around the city for the first 2 days. I basically gave him an itinerary that I wanted to pursue, and he was my guide and spoke to me for hours and hours on end about the situation in Russia and the people of Russia. And then I began to meet people on my own at that stage and began to have a number of very interesting conversations from people across the political spectrum, some of whom were non-Russians living in Russia and in a couple of cases in Crimea. And I engaged a translator in Crimea at my own expense, who was not a government employee, worked in the private sector, a professional translator, and also she found for me a driver who could take us around Crimea, and I went all over Crimea. And, you know, what I found in my discussions with people, there's so much I could say, I'll try to sort of highlight it briefly, is that, first of all, they expressed no one was hostile towards me, which was quite surprising because, you know, as soon as I opened my mouth, people knew I was from North America. And frankly, the United States and Canada are at war with Russia. We are clearly at war with Russia. We just don't want to call it a war. That's certainly how they view it. Rightly or wrongly, that's their perspective. And yet, when they spoke to me, they were very polite, very gracious. And in fact, the more we spoke and the more they found me willing to listen to their perspective, the warmer they were with me. And I was quite impressed by the fact that I never once encountered any hostility from anybody in Russia. A lot of them spoke very kindly and almost sympathetically about people in the West. And they feel very strongly, the people I spoke to, that Western governments are pursuing a destructive course of action that could end terribly for us all. They even spoke very kindly of the Ukrainian people, referred to them as family members, brothers and sisters. But they have almost universal contempt for the government of Ukraine and feel that it is not serving the interests of the people of Ukraine. There was a lot of support for the government expressed to me, the government of Russia, Vladimir Putin. And this is reflected, by the way, in polls by an agency called Levada that has been widely cited in the West and that whose management is actually critical of Vladimir Putin. It shows that currently his approval rating is in excess of 80%. To the extent there was criticism of him, it was not the criticism that you hear in the West. Their criticism was he should have intervened in Ukraine earlier before its military was built up by NATO to become a threat to Russian speakers in the Donbass and even to Russia itself. That was their perception. And also a lot of people told me that they didn't think that the Russian military was being aggressive enough in bringing this war to a successful conclusion. It was being too restrained. This is certainly not what we hear in the media. And again, I'm simply conveying to you what I heard. I think overall the picture that I received was of a country that is mostly united behind its government, feels that it is existentially threatened. That is a genuine feeling of many, many Russians, I would say probably a large majority of Russians, and is determined to prevail in this conflict if they can't achieve some kind of a reasonable negotiated solution. And frankly, there's absolutely no indication that the governments of the West and their ally in Ukraine have the slightest interest in any kind of a meaningful negotiation. I cannot underline this enough. As a lawyer who did dispute resolution for over 30 years, involving large, complex class actions and very sophisticated opponents, I can tell you that if you're not prepared to compromise and to concede something, anything, to your counterparty, there will be no settlement. There will be, and this war will continue until one side wins or loses. And that side is almost certainly going to be Ukraine because of the tremendous advantages that Russia enjoys on the battlefield at this moment. And if we're lucky, it'll only be Ukraine. I say that with tremendous sympathy for and fear for the destiny of the Ukrainian people. If we're unlucky, it's going to end up killing us all. That's where we're headed. I can't stress it enough. And I think that we need to start listening to our brothers and sisters in Russia, because, yes, it's not only the people of Ukraine who are brothers and sisters. They most certainly are. It's also the people of Russia who are brothers and sisters. We are all human beings, and we have a collective interest in bringing this war to an end as quickly as possible by means of mutual compromise.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. This is Mary Jane Eason, the host of Mishal on Wooden Spoons. We're talking to Dmitry Lascaris about the war going on in Ukraine. You mentioned the 2014, the toppling of the Yanukovych government. I think that was under Obama, who spoke with the silver tongue, but he turned out to be a very warlike person. Anybody? So that the Eastern Ukraine, I guess that is an area where there's a lot of Russian people living there. They're both Ukrainian and Russian, and maybe they have some differences amongst them with the more central Ukraine. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah. So the president's name is the one who was deposed is Viktor Yanukovych.
Thank you.
That's all right. He was democratically elected in 2010. And you hear many people say he is corrupt. Well, I think there's strong indications that that has been a tradition in Ukrainian politics, sadly. And in fact, Poroshenko, who is constantly quoted, this is the prior president. I'm sorry, the president who came after the Yanukovych was overthrown and is widely cited in the Western media. He was accused by the Zelensky government in 2022, just before the invasion was launched, of high treason, of having enriched himself at the expense of the Ukrainian state. And the Canadian media reported at the time that Poroshenko was not arrested by the Zelensky regime early in 2022 because of the intervention. Again, intervention in Ukrainian politics by the West, and namely, it was our own prime minister and Chrystia Freeland who intervened and pressured Zelensky into not arresting Poroshenko for his alleged treason and corruption. So the fact of the matter is that Yanukovych, whether or not he was corrupt, which, as I say, seems to be a tradition in Ukrainian politics, he was democratically elected, and this was widely acknowledged by the West. There were election observers from all over the world in Ukraine at the time. And the only reason he was overthrown was because he didn't want to be hostile to Russia. And why was he of this inclination? Because the people who supported him, and you can see this in electoral maps that are available on Wikipedia, became predominantly from areas in the southeast of Ukraine and Crimea, people who wanted to have good relations to Russia, who were Russian speakers themselves. A number of them have family members in Russia, and they identify closely. There's no crime in this. They identify closely from a cultural and linguistic and religious and political perspective with Russia. And so they wanted a president who was going to maintain good relations with the country, which is something, frankly, that would be in the interest of the Ukrainian people. They're next door to a behemoth that has nuclear weapons, also has massive resources and a considerable amount of technology. Why wouldn't it be in the interest of the Ukrainian people that they be on good terms with Russia and as well with Europe, as Yanukovych was trying to do? And so when he was overthrown, and it was so obvious that this was a coup orchestrated by the West, that George Friedman, who at the time was the CEO of Stratfor, a U.S.-based geopolitical consulting firm that's closely tied to the U.S. government, called it the most blatant coup in history. And when he was overthrown, the view of these people was that their vote had been stolen from them, that their democratic rights had been undermined. And they said, and quickly, in quick order after he was overthrown, a government was installed that was clearly hostile to Russia and began to adopt laws which impinged upon the language rights of the people who had supported Yanukovych and who lived in the southeast of Ukraine and Crimea principally, although they're all over Ukraine. And I want to tell you about one, just one of the many interactions I had. I spoke with people all over Crimea, who all of whom said that they wanted to be part of Russia. Not one person in Crimea told me that they wanted to return to live under the jurisdiction of the government in Kiev. But I met a man in Moscow by the name of Mikhail, who's a math professor now at a Moscow university. And the way I came to meet him was that somebody, a Canadian of Russian origin who follows me on Facebook, told me she had family members from this part of Ukraine, the southeastern part, particularly the Donbass, who had suffered as a result of the war and who, you know, wanted their part of what had been Ukraine to become part of Russia. And I asked her to put me in touch with her family members, and this led to a meeting with this man. And what he told me, we sat down, spoke for 2 hours. I interviewed him. The interview is set out in detail on my website. And he said to me, my mother is of Ukrainian origin. My father is of Russian origin. I was born and raised in a village in southeastern Ukraine, which is 10 kilometers now from the front line. My mother is still there. My older brother is still there. I have friends, there are people known to our family who died fighting against the government in Ukraine who are now pro-Russian. I'm going to try to go back there this summer. And if the Russian government hadn't intervened, he said, I would have enlisted in the militia in my area to fight against the Ukrainian military. But thankfully, they intervened. And he said, you know, when people criticize Russia for intervening, what I say to them is, do you want the Ukrainian military to kill my mother? Because that's what might very well happen if the Russian military is not there to protect people who are of this political inclination and this this cultural orientation. That's his view. You can disagree with it, but that's his view. And it was my strong feeling talking to him that it's sincere. And, you know, he said, there is no question that the people that I know in the Donbass who are still living there, family members, friends, they all want to be part of Russia. And this is a real thing. We're not told about this. But of course, we hear about the perspective of people who are opposed to Russia and Ukraine, the people who are living in areas controlled by the Ukrainian military. That is a great thing that we hear from them. We should hear from them. Their voices are absolutely critical in this conversation. But we don't hear from these people, people like Mikhail, his mother, his older brother, and how they feel about this. And so we're given this, you know, what I call Star Wars version of the war, in which, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky, our ally, effectively plays the role of Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Vladimir Putin is Darth Vader, and we're on the side of Obi. You know, it's all black and white. One side is pure and saintly, and the other side is evil and must be defeated at all costs. Well, that's not the reality. This is not a Hollywood blockbuster. My friends, this is a very, very complicated situation, and there are legitimate grievances on both sides. And these grievances can be resolved by negotiation and by mutual compromise and goodwill. But we're not even making any effort to do that, despite the enormity of the stakes.
I know there are people from Ukraine that live in Canada, and I know that there are pockets of populations in Winnipeg. I once was at a church in the north end of Winnipeg. I can't remember where exactly the location, but I was there, and they had a whole sort of a museum in the basement, and they were promoting this bishop that was a sort of a saintly bishop that was escaped. Well, they had a very dim view of Russia, and they were very anti-Russian, and Russia was seen as like they're going back to the Stalinist era where a lot of Ukrainians, I guess, suffered under Stalin. And so I think we're seeing a lot of people that came from Ukraine that have this view, and they are in Winnipeg. Do you want to comment on that? Like, they're
sure.
But my yeah. experience.
Yes, I understand. You know, the feelings of people who believe passionately, whether they be Ukrainian or non-Ukrainian, that the Ukrainian people deserve to have a sovereign state, and that they were deprived of their right to a sovereign state during the Soviet era. Those are legitimate grievances and feelings, to be sure. And I understand how you know, this can make people who have that belief about Ukrainian sovereignty feel very antagonistic towards Russia. But it is also true, as I said, that there are feelings on the Russian side that are very real and understandable. For example, the fact that the Soviet Union lost some 27 million people as a result of the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, and sacrificed far more than all of the Western allies combined. Even when you throw into their hopper not only the Western allied casualties, but the casualties of Germany itself, the primary aggressor, the Soviets, and that's primarily the Russians, also the Ukrainians, sustained far greater casualties. And here we have the world's most powerful military alliance, okay, which has a collective budget of $1.2 trillion a year, some 20 times larger than the Russian Federation's annual military budget, fueling a war a few hundred kilometers from Moscow using Western, including German weaponry and German heavy tanks. So how do you think the Russian people feel about that? I mean, their feeling of, you know, they're doing it again. You know, Western powers are again trying to destroy our country, are waging war upon us, an aggressive military alliance that left Libya in smoking ruins, left Afghanistan in smoking ruins, bombarded Serbia so heavily that they killed hundreds upon hundreds of innocent civilians. They view it as a massive, threatening, and highly aggressive military alliance. It's on their border, and they see this as an existential threat. So these feelings on both sides of the conflict are very real. We're only told about, you know, the Ukrainian feelings of having lived under the Soviet yoke, which are entirely understandable. But we're not told about how the Russians view this and what they experienced during the Second World War at the hands of Western European aggressors.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also, you know, this has been called a NATO war. The NATO group has been establishing bases on near Russian borders. And this has been seen as trying to provoke Russia. And so do you want to comment on the development there with mm-hmm. the NATO forces being surrounding Russia?
Yeah, I think we should go back a little bit further than the current encirclement of Russia and talk about the withdrawal of the Bush administration in 2004 from a cornerstone treaty of nuclear disarmament, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. It withdrew from that treaty. It was a very provocative step with over the objections of the Russian Federation. Then in 2018, the Trump administration went even further. This was extremely destabilizing withdrew from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, arguably an even more important treaty in terms of nuclear disarmament and avoiding nuclear war. Again, did so over the objections of the Russian Federation. In that same year, it also withdrew from the Trump administration from the nuclear deal with Iran. It's probably the one good thing that Obama did, was enter into a deal with Iran that gave sanctions relief in return for assurances, verifiable assurances, that the Iranians would not develop a nuclear weapon. So Trump withdrew from that, even though the IAEA certified at the time that Iran was complying with the deal. So all of these provocative steps, and by the way, there are now missile launchers in Romania, which are nuclear capable. And the Russian fear, and I think it's an entirely understandable one, was that these nuclear launchers would next be placed in Ukraine itself, and that you'd have nuclear-tipped missiles just minutes away from Moscow. This is an extremely dangerous situation, not just for Russia, but for us, because if any one of those were launched in a preemptive strike of some kind, and let's remember that the United States government is the only government in the world that has ever used these weapons of mass destruction, and it used them on civilian targets at the end of the Second World War when Japan was on the verge of surrender. So looking at it from the Russian perspective, the entry of NATO military forces into Ukraine and potentially nuclear weapons was an absolute red line that it would not tolerate. We kept saying over a period of years that we were going to cross that red line, even though NATO leaders back at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union assured its government and Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO would not expand eastward. And so in the lead up to the war, you had not only now did you have NATO military forces in the Baltics and Poland and Romania, but now they were on the verge of going into Ukraine. And they also tried but failed to bring Georgia into NATO. And basically what would have happened if the West had succeeded in that regard was that the Black Sea, which provides is of strategic importance to Russia and provides it with its only warm water port in Sevastopol, would have become a NATO lake. It would have been surrounded by NATO states. As I say, potentially nuclear-tipped missiles would have been minutes away from Moscow. The Americans and the Ukrainians were doing heavy military exercises in Ukraine, and I believe also in the Black Sea itself leading up to the invasion. And they were pumping weapons into Ukraine and training its military up to NATO standards. So again, all of this, I don't know how anybody cannot understand in the West that the Russian Federation's government and its people felt threatened by all of this. It's obvious that they felt threatened, and we were playing with fire. And to be perfectly blunt about it, I think the most plausible interpretation of the behavior of the British and American governments in the several years prior to this invasion is that they were trying to provoke a war. They were trying to provoke a war because they wanted to sever the energy relationship between Russia and Europe, force the Europeans to buy liquefied natural gas from the United States, weaken Germany, which was heavily dependent upon Russian gas, weaken Russia, which was selling large amounts of its natural resources to Europe, and ultimately have the perfect pretext for imposing sanctions upon Russia that would devastate its economy and possibly cause the overthrow of its president. That was the plan. I think it's pretty clear now that that was the plan. And what we should really be alarmed about is if this plan were to succeed, I don't think it will. I think it will end in tragically in the destruction of Ukraine and possibly nuclear war. But if this plan succeeds, it's very clear where they're going next. They are going to do the same scam with the Chinese, and particularly using Taiwan as the tip of the NATO spear against China. And if we get through this war, the one in Ukraine without a nuclear exchange, I think it would be downright miraculous if we survived as a species a war between China and the United States. And that's where this is heading, ladies and gentlemen. We need to wake up to this reality before it's too late.
Okay, so we are going to be, maybe just one more comment, and I think if you're willing to come on next week, Dmitry, that would be wonderful to continue this discussion, because I think it's so important that we hear this perspective. And you have emphasized that this war is putting the entire world in danger of a nuclear event, and you also quoted Noam Chomsky in your talk as saying that we are living in the most dangerous part of history, which you were just explaining how dangerous it is. And just one more thing maybe you could comment on before we close this part of our program. And a striking point you made, that you were emphasizing that the war between Ukraine and Russia is not supported by most of the world. And you showed a map that showed Asia, Africa, and South America are not on board with this war. So what does that tell us about the conflict between Russia and Ukraine in terms of the world opinion?
Yes, you can go on the internet, anybody who's interested, and find the maps compiled by the Economic Intelligence Unit of Economist Magazine, which is very pro-NATO, very anti-Russia. And what you'll see is that virtually no country in Latin America, including Mexico, by the way, our close trading partner, virtually no country in Africa, the Middle East, or Asia itself, I mean, other than South Korea and Japan, have provided weapons to Ukraine or are imposing sanctions on Russia. And so the view that, and what they're saying is we need to bring this war to an end. And people like Lula in Brazil are offering themselves up as mediators to try and negotiate an end to this war. What I've been saying to you during this conversation, happy to continue it next week, is really mainstream outside of the West. This is a Western-fueled war against Russia. This is not the international community against Russia. That's just a blatant lie. And we in the West do not speak for the global South. It is very clear that the global South and the eastern part of the world, where the vast majority of the human population reside, they're not on board with what we're doing in Ukraine. And so I want Canadians, I ask my fellow Canadians to think about the fact that we are the outliers. We in the West, we are not supported by the vast majority of the human population of what we're doing in Ukraine.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning, and I look forward to resuming our conversation next week.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
And at this point, we could have a song, Nishal, perhaps, and station identification. Thank you for listening to WCPQ.
So weary, but I must go along till the Lord comes and called me away. Oh, yes. Well, the morning's so bright and alive.
Peace in a valley for
gente já hang up? Hello?
Hello? Is this Dimitri?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. I'm a little confused here. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. You've really shared such amazing information. And, you know, what can I say? You are just an amazing peacemaker.
Thank you so much.
I really appreciate what you said, what you shared.
Thank you for having me.
See you next week.
Okay, talk to you then. Have a good weekend.
Okay, you too. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay.
Welcome back to CKU 95.9 FM. You've been listening to Wooden Spoons, and so far, so long, it is so good. I hope you'll have a good weekend, everyone. And yeah, welcome back, Mary Jane.
Okay. I'm just going to continue on the second part of our program. I wanted to talk about one of the things that is a nutritional issue, and that is the concept of fake foods, fake meat. And this is I'm going to share some information from the Organic Consumers Association, and they reported that in March 2023, the Italian government supported a ban that bans lab-grown foods because they care about the impact. They are concerned about the impact lab-grown meats could have on their people and their farmers and the environment. Advocates say that lab-grown meats are safe and they are ethical, and they will help battle climate change. And it's interesting, the whole concept of climate change suddenly has a lot of corporate interests backing it, and that argument is used to support many ideas that are really corporate interests. And so I feel uncomfortable with this kind of situation with climate change now becoming promoted by corporations. Anyway, so they're saying that it helps to battle climate change, and consumers do have questions about the ethics, safety of the processes and ingredients used. Now, the media components, which would be the substances used in seed and the production of cultures, they use a basal media, they call it, of amino acids, vitamins, inorganic salts, and other supplements, which also includes fetal bovine serum. It includes folic acid, ferric nitrate, hypoxanthine, sodium, lipoic acid, putrescine, sodium pyruvate, thymidine, pleuronic F16-8, fetal bovine serum. And there are other additional nutrients that they put in the bioreactor, D-glucose dextrose, sodium hydroxide, and hydrochloric acid. This is part of the making of the fake meat. The health concerns about lab meat is that the bovine bovine serum is obtained by sucking the blood out of a living cow fetus, and the fetus does not survive this procedure to get the fetal bovine serum. And one particular concern is the genetic engineering of cells and their potential cancer-promoting properties. genetic constructs called oncogenes are used to make stem cells, and they keep them growing. And they may be a problem for food products that might encourage cancer cells. So these are some of the issues that consumers need to be aware of. They also need to be aware of the fact that fake meat is not cruelty-free. Many producers extract animal cells from living animals using a biopsy, which is a painful procedure that uses large needles. Innumerable painful extractions are made. So the biopsy of the same animal can be done many times. So this is not a cruelty-free procedure. If lab-cultured meat enters the market, there are several human health concerns associated with the new production method, specifically that these genetically modified cell lines could exhibit characteristics of a cancerous cell. Companies don't disclose much to the public.